please the court, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. My name is Steve Staparo, and I represent the appellant Brian Dorsey in this case. Mr. Ahern represents the appellant Christopher Keating. I'll be presenting oral argument on behalf of both appellants this morning. Your Honors, with regards to our arguments in the opening brief, appellants raised four arguments. First, appellants argued that the lower court erred as a matter of law in holding that Ohio law applied rather than Delaware law. Appellants argue that Delaware law applies based on an out-of-state coverage extension provision language in the Cincinnati Insurance Company contract.
Why is that choice of law issue irrelevant? That is, why is it dispositive, which I gather you're arguing?
In the transcript of the motion for summary judgment, and as the court asked the same question to Mr. Tai, it's very relevant in this case because Delaware law and Ohio law differ greatly on what is allowed in terms of exclusions. Ohio law allows intentional act exclusions, whereas Delaware law may not. The Cincinnati Insurance Company policy determines issues from the standpoint of the insured rather than from the standpoint of the injured party.
I read that in your brief, but nobody developed that. That is, nobody applied that difference to the facts of this case, at least in a way that I was able to understand.
I think it was something, and I agree with you, Your Honor, when I read the transcript, I understand that. I think the reason for that, I think it's understood. Mr. Tai, at the lower court's argument, when faced with the same question, explained that if Ohio law applies, then the exclusion may be valid, and they recognize intentional act exclusions, they recognize issues of permission, whereas they recognize determining an accident and even the expected or intended injury exclusion from the standpoint of view of the insured rather than the injured party. That's crucial under Delaware law because Delaware law does not.
But if you view those exclusions from the standpoint of the insured rather than the plaintiff, how is the result different?
Well, very different. If you do it from the viewpoint of the insured, all the insured has to do is expect to injure you and you don't get compensated. But in Delaware, if it's viewed from the standpoint of view of the injured party, it is more consistent with understanding the term, it's an accident, not an intentional act, not an expected injury. And therefore, it's a major difference in the law. Under Delaware law, the plaintiffs have a greater chance of recovery financially.
You're saying that under Delaware law, the acts that occurred here would be viewed as an accident?
No, I'm saying, Your Honor, that under Delaware law, there would just be different requirements in terms of interpreting the insurance contract, which may be more favorable to the appellants than under Ohio law. So, continuing on then, the first argument was that, and also under the most significant relationship test, we still felt that Delaware law would apply. The second argument then that the appellants make is taking the out of state coverage extension language of the policy and viewing that in a decision by then-Judge Ridgely, the Watts v. Universal Underwriters case. Appellants feel that case is directly on point. It involved a vehicle that, under an out-of-state exclusion, basically was rendered uninsured in violation of Delaware's minimum requirement of financial responsibility. And based on that holding, the exclusion was determined to be invalid, and the plaintiff was afforded coverage under Delaware law. Thirdly, the next argument was that the exclusions in the Cincinnati Insurance Company expected or intended injury exclusion violates Delaware public policy to compensate all victims of auto accidents and should be void per se because it fails to meet the minimum requirements of the liability law in Delaware.
Is it your position that the out-of-state coverage extensions include not only the statutory requirements, but those requirements as interpreted by the case law of a jurisdiction?
Yes, it is, Justice Ridgely. That's exactly the argument of the appellants. The appellants argue that in terms of whether coverage applies, not only just the amounts of coverage that are significant, but the types of exclusions that Delaware allows versus what an out-of-state, which Ohio in this case would allow. There are exclusions that Ohio allows that Delaware does not allow. Ohio allows things to be determined from the standpoint of the insured, whereas Delaware does not do that. It recognizes it from the standpoint of the injured party in accordance with its public policy of trying to compensate all victims of auto accidents that are injured.
Does that cut the other way if this language was in a Delaware policy and the accident was in Ohio, that the policy would, or the coverage would narrow?
I think it would. Under the out-of-state coverage extension, the language says that when an out-of-state vehicle, in this case an Ohio vehicle, comes into Delaware, they are agreeing to comply with the not only the terms of Delaware law, but any type of coverage issues that Delaware law may decide, especially with regards to exclusions, with regards to whether it's determined to be an accident. A lot of the insurance policies have the same language.
It doesn't say that, though, does it? I mean, the clause that you're relying on simply talks about the minimum dollar coverages.
Well, you know, I believe it's implicit in there that it may just mention limits in terms of meeting the limits, but what good is meeting the limits if you're not meeting the coverage issues that Delaware requires? That's not going to protect Delaware residents, where you simply say in an auto policy, well, we're going to agree to comply with the limits. So if the limits are 15 and we only have 5, we'll increase them to 15. But then on the other hand, allow exclusions, which would take that coverage rate out of the picture.
Your argument is that even though the statute doesn't explicitly do any more than equalize the limits, implicitly it sweeps into its coverage all of the Delaware law on exclusions and affirmative coverage. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I think the language not only
is there a case that supports you on that?
I think the White case does. You know, that's one of the ones that we rely on. But they relied on the out-of-state coverage extension provision, which is identical to the exact provision that's in the Cincinnati Insurance Company case. And I think that is what allowed Delaware law to control. And I think if I, in reading that case and thinking through this argument, I believe that if the out-of-state coverage extension language is extended and Delaware law applies, I think Cincinnati does have to comply with the financial responsibility law as it's been defined and interpreted by Delaware courts. And so, yes, the reasons that things like how an accident is defined or whether intentional act exclusions are recognized is very important, because Delaware law has case law and has already made decisions as to coverage issues that exist in Delaware. And I think,
is there case law that says that anywhere besides, I know you like Watts, but is there, this out-of-state coverage extension is a rather common clause, isn't it? And hasn't it been interpreted to include the case law of the jurisdiction, which is the out-of-state?
I can't think of a case that comes to mind to answer that, so I'm not going to be able to give you a case at this time. But I do believe that language, even though it, and as the appellee points out, it's a routine language, but it's very crucial in this case, because the goal of Delaware's public policy is to protect residents that are injured in Delaware, especially by out-of-state vehicles. And that language, although it may be a customary and a standard provision in policies, is to accomplish just that. The effect is to meet the financial responsibility laws of the state in which the auto is being used. That's what the policy says. Whether it's routine or not, it's in the policy, and I think it's clear that that's what they have to do. And I think if Delaware is going to allow other businesses to come in and use their automobiles on Delaware highways, that they have to comply with Delaware law in all respects, not just putting a dollar figure and saying, well, we've met the limits there. And that's why I think it's important that they do that.
Well, is that the expectation of the contracting parties, that when they buy insurance and the insurance company sells insurance, that it's going to provide them the minimum coverage, not only in their own state, but wherever they drive?
Well, it must be some intention that they have, because they include that provision in their policy. They recognize that, in this case, Lack Roofing is going to do business in other states, and that their vehicles are going to be used in other states. And they also recognize, by the language incorporated there in that provision, that there are financial responsibility laws in different states that they have to meet if they're going to drive upon the highways of that state. And I think that's why that provision's in there.
But doesn't your argument go further than the financial responsibility laws? I mean, I read your argument to be that if an Ohio insured, that is insured under a policy that's issued in Ohio, comes into Delaware, under the Delaware law is applied to the Ohio policy, and particularly that financial responsibility clause, results in Delaware law trumping Ohio law in any respect where there's an inconsistency?
I don't know if it'll be in any respect, Your Honor. I think it does trump it in terms of the coverage issues, in terms of how...
Well, coverage and exclusions are pretty much the name of the game, isn't it? That's everything other than limits.
Well, I have to agree with Your Honor. In terms of, if you're looking in terms of exclusions, et cetera, I don't know procedurally if it trumps everything under Ohio law. I think in terms of coverage issues, yes. I think Delaware law would trump the Ohio policy, and that their vehicles would have to comply with Delaware law in all respects in order to promote Delaware's prominent interest in protecting its citizens from being injured in auto accidents and getting compensation.
And my question, and I'm really referring back to Justice Ridgely's, is that a reasonable interpretation of what the parties to this insurance policy would have expected?
Again, Your Honor, I can't get into their minds, but basically based on the language that they incorporated that particular provision in the policy, I'd have to say yes. They recognize that they're driving in other states that have to meet the financial responsibility laws of those states.
Under your construction of the policy, not only would Delaware law trump Ohio law, but if this accident took place in Colorado or California or Nevada, their state's law would trump Ohio law as well.
I would think it would, except the one difference in Delaware is Delaware, in interpreting its Financial Responsibility Act, has given great significance in the purpose of that act.
If the other states did the same,
then yes, I would agree with you. The out-of-state coverage extension language of that contract would then mandate that Cincinnati would have to adhere to the financial responsibility laws of those states, and that the policy, in terms of being determining whether there's coverage, would have to be judged in terms of the law and the case law and how coverage issues apply in that particular state.
That means that the scope of the financial risk that the insurance company is on the line for could vary tremendously depending on whether or not you cross the state line and which state line you cross.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but I think implicit in that is whenever you use a vehicle and drive upon a state's highways, you're agreeing to comply with that state's laws, not only the rules of the road, but I think you should have to comply with the laws in terms of case law and how insurance coverage is determined.
Well, certainly the driver of the vehicle is required to comply with the law of the state where the vehicle is, but we're talking about the coverage of an insurance policy.
You're correct, Your Honor.
And is it not the case that one can distinguish between parity of financial responsibility results and all of the other issues relating to coverage and exclusions?
Well, I think when you have an exclusion that violates that state's law, that exclusion should not be recognized in that state. And I think Cincinnati understands that when they take a vehicle and go to that particular state to gain a profit, to do work, to use their vehicles to expend their business, I think that's a risk they have to understand exists. And I think they do. I think that's why the provision is in there. They have to comply with the financial responsibility acts of whatever state they drive in. They know that. That's why the policy says it.
Okay. Would you answer my question?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Which is, is there not a distinction to be drawn between financial responsibility acts and all of the other provisions of an insurance policy that relate to coverage and or exclusions therefrom?
I don't know if I'm answering your question, but to the extent that there is no conflict, well, then I don't see an issue. I think it's only on those provisions that conflict with that state's law. And I'm sorry if I'm not answering your question, but that's as far as I can go on that. Additionally, let me say that there is an issue of material fact, and this was a motion for summary judgment, obviously, that was granted, but appellants argue that there was testimony below by Christopher Batten, who was a co-worker assigned to Mr. Goldick's crew, Mr. Goldick being the driver. And there was a telephone conversation that occurred on the very night of the incident at 3:30 in the morning. Mr. Goldick called Mr. Batten and gave him a version of how he described the incident occurred. And Mr. Goldick told Mr. Batten that Mr. Gerlich's passenger, who was a Mr. McNeese, grabbed the wheel and yanked it to the right, and that thereby striking individuals, including the appellants. That was corroborated in terms of deposition testimony when you look at the personality of McNeese and how Christopher Batten described him, and also Warren Reynolds. They described him as a real troublemaker, very obnoxious. He was a real jerk, to put it bluntly. No one got along with him. So I think there, in terms of the hearsay argument that was raised, I just would refer the court to Rule 801D2, which says that that type of statement is not hearsay. It is an admission by a party opponent. And that's because the statement was offered against the party, and it's his own statement.
Mr. Stefara, you're into your rebuttal time. You can use it if you'd like.
Just one more point, and then I'll sit down. Thank you. Also, on the hearsay exception rule, if it was determined to be hearsay, which appellants argue it's not under Rule 801, under 803, there's an excited utterance exception to hearsay, which says a statement relating to a startling event or condition made while the declarant was under the stress or excitement caused by the event or condition. This happened within hours of the event. He was in police custody, and we think that exception would apply. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Michael Tai. I represent Cincinnati Insurance Company. Appellants argue that the out-of-state extension clause in the Cincinnati Insurance Company policy acts as a choice of law provision.
They conceded otherwise in their brief, didn't they? It's not a choice of law provision.
They agree it's not, but it acts that way. I think they seem to be trying to have it both ways, Your Honor. That's what I heard just now, that it somehow operates in that regard and serves as a choice of law. Perhaps I misunderstood Mr. Stefara, but we contend it is what it is, and it states very clearly what it is. It is not a choice of law provision. We're all familiar with those. They say in case of dispute, this contract will be construed or interpreted according to the laws of a particular state. And it doesn't say that.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding the argument here, but my belief is that Mr. Stefara is saying not that it is a quote-unquote choice of law provision. It is a provision that governs what law is applicable in Delaware, and he would like us to read it more broadly than perhaps the exact language is, and say it not only determines what the level of coverage is in another jurisdiction, but in order for that determination to be meaningful, it has to also control how that coverage is interpreted in that other jurisdiction. So it's maybe a little bit different than calling it a choice of law provision.
I think it still has the same effect, though. Ultimately, Judge Carpenter was faced with the issue of deciding what law applied when he construed this contract of insurance. And he said there is no choice of law provision, and then resolved it by use of the restatement of conflicts, which is the requirement under Delaware law. And he did that and determined that there was no question that Ohio law applied because of where the contract was made, the contracting parties, the brokerage, the payments, all of those
factors.
Right,
but that's kind of the traditional choice of law analysis. Did the lower court actually discuss or consider the idea that even if this is not a choice of law question, that the language ought to be interpreted in such a way as to provide the Delaware judicial gloss, if you will, on the contract language?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think we understood it to mean that this somehow served as a choice of law provision, and Judge Carpenter is faced with interpreting and construing a contract and following a restatement of conflicts. And following Delaware law, he determined that Ohio law had to apply.
But did he abrogate the out-of-state coverage extension by doing that?
Well, ultimately, yes, because he found there was no coverage at all. And I think what does...
Well, let me follow up on that. What is the out-of-state coverage that this contract provides for in Delaware?
Minimum coverage equal to the minimum financial responsibility laws, which would be $15,000 per person, $30,000 per accident in liability coverage.
Doesn't the policy, Cincinnati's policy, essentially say for matters that are expected or intended, the coverage limit is $0?
Correct.
And in Delaware, the coverage limit is $15,000, $30,000 per expected or intended.
For Delaware registered vehicles, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So why doesn't the out-of-state coverage extension basically expand the $0 coverage up to the minimum limits?
Well, I think the Watts case is instructive here, your decision. In Watts, there was an out-of-state registered vehicle, the Maryland vehicle, that came into Delaware. It had an exclusion, struck a pedestrian. There was PIP, or no-fault coverage, personal injury protection coverage. And the court was looking at the Delaware no-fault statute, which has a provision that says that a vehicle registered in another state coming here to Delaware has to have coverage equal to what is called for in its home state. And applying the exclusion that was urged left that vehicle with no coverage. And that triggered the out-of-state extension and imposed Delaware coverage. Now, there is no comparable statute regarding liability coverage in Delaware. The financial responsibility laws don't say that. It's unique to PIP.
So we're back to the issue then of whether the financial responsibility laws in Delaware include the statute as interpreted by the case law.
Could you say it again, Your Honor? I want to make sure I understand your question.
In terms of limits specified by a compulsory or financial responsibility law, the language of the out-of-state coverage extension, does that mean simply the statute, or does that mean the statute as interpreted by the case law in Delaware?
I think simply the statute. I think
meaning that the only effect of that statute is to require the Delaware coverage limits.
If Delaware had limits that were higher than what was on the policy, as the vehicle crosses state lines, the higher coverage goes into effect.
Right, but there would be no additional sweeping in of Delaware case law requirements or other cases that interpret coverage or exclusions.
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's entirely possible for vehicles, even Delaware registered vehicles, to end up with no coverage under certain exclusions. For example, if a car is used without permission, if it's stolen, there's no obligation, and that could be a Delaware registered vehicle, and the thief injures people, there's no obligation to provide coverage. That's currently the law in this jurisdiction, so the financial responsibility laws don't trump that situation and impose minimum financial responsibility.
They don't trump all exclusions,
correct.
In Delaware.
That's correct. Even in Delaware, and I think most certainly not in involving vehicles coming from other jurisdictions. I think this Watts case was unique because of the statute we have here that says if a vehicle comes from another state, it has to have on it the coverage that is called for in that other state, which it ultimately didn't, according to this exclusion, and that's why the court then went to the out-of-state extension.
Well, maybe I'm confused, but let me ask it another way, or ask it again until I understand it better. Isn't the intent of the out-of-state coverage extension to provide the insured the minimum coverage required under the law in the state where that person will be driving?
I think it is. Yes, sir.
And isn't the minimum coverage in Delaware under the law of the state of Delaware, coverage that would include a event that was expected or intended.
Well, yes, that's the Hudson case, that an intentional act is viewed from the point of view of the victim, and that hence as an accident. Yes.
Well, if the answer to those two questions are yes, then why doesn't this out-of-state coverage extension require the $15,000, $30,000 coverage for this incident?
Because that's a Delaware registered vehicle. The case was construed according to Delaware law because the contract was issued in Delaware. This contract was issued in Ohio. Judge Carpenter was correct to construe it according to Ohio law. Ohio law recognizes the intentional or expected act exclusion and honors it and enforces it. It would render no coverage, but I think it's still the correct decision.
We asked this question of opposing counsel and didn't get an answer. Perhaps you have one. Since I gather that this out-of-state extension language is fairly common in insurance policies, one would think that this issue, whether that language covers more than just policy limits in another jurisdiction, or whether it also encompasses the case law that goes along with how those policy limits are interpreted in that other jurisdiction, somewhere around the country one would think that another court has looked at this question. Are you aware of any authority on this point?
I am not, Your Honor. I have certainly seen insurance policies that contain both clauses, which would indicate that this out-of-state extension is not meant to be in any way a choice of law provision, either directly or indirectly. But I'm not aware of any jurisdiction that has taken that out-of-state extension language and used it to effectively as a choice of law provision. Which
is there a difference between choice of law and choice of coverage? Is it a choice of coverage position?
I think, not to be facetious, but the choice of law determines what the coverage is. So it's very clear that Ohio law applied. Ohio law allows this exclusion for expected or intended behavior, and it renders the act uninsured.
But if we substitute Delaware is obviously out of state from Ohio. This language would read, Delaware coverage extensions. While a covered auto is away from Ohio, we will increase the limit of insurance for liability coverage to meet the limit or limits specified by a compulsory or financial responsibility law in Delaware. Where is that essentially what this statute or what this language means in this context?
My understanding is that I can't answer the question better than I did before. When the vehicle crosses a particular state line, if that state has higher limits, then the vehicle is covered automatically by those higher limits. But I think the concept of exclusion exists equally with that or parallel to it and can eliminate coverage.
Can I follow up on that a minute?
Yes.
You cross the line into Delaware, and let's just assume for a moment that Delaware actually has lower compulsory limits than Ohio instead of higher. Would the level of coverage go down?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The
okay, so
clause doesn't
and,
call for that.
Right, and that's what I kind of assumed. So the contract in Ohio provides a baseline of coverage. And then says if you go somewhere else and there's more coverage under the law of that jurisdiction, you get the additional coverage.
Correct.
Doesn't that, the fact that this is a floor with a mechanism for increasing the floor, doesn't that suggest that the intention was that you actually be able to recover that additional amount? That, in other words, that the laws of that jurisdiction would apply?
Well, I think, the law of that jurisdiction that mandates what the minimum financial responsibility is would apply. But I don't think it carries on beyond that to say that the contract that was negotiated between the parties in their state, which contains exclusions which are valid and enforceable, would disappear.
Mr. Dyke, Mr. Stirparo closed his presentation by referring to an issue of material fact. My question is, number one, what is your response? Number two, to what extent, if at all, was this argued below, and how did the court deal with it?
I certainly don't concede that there's any issue of material fact. Judge Carpenter was correct in viewing this record as so one-sided as to not make it reasonable to send this to a jury and ask them to determine whether Mr. Goldick's actions were an accident or whether he expected or intended the consequences. The record, which is before the court, shows a number of witnesses who supported the idea that Mr. Goldick went to this bar, was drinking, got into a fight, was ejected, tried repeatedly to get back in, was rebuffed by bouncers, got into a fight outside the bar with a bouncer, was basically subdued or beaten up, went to his van, the company van, got in it, and aimed it at the 11 people standing outside the bar and accelerated into them so fast that he hit the front of the bar and damaged it.
Well, other side argues that there was another person in the front of the vehicle who pulled the steering wheel in the wrong direction. My question is, was that argued below? And secondly, what did the court rule with respect to the argument?
Well, I don't remember that particular fact being raised. It may have been, and I simply don't recall it. But Mr. Goldick then tried to flee, tires flat, he was caught. He makes a phone call from the jail at 3:30 in the morning, and he calls this worker, Mr. Batten, whose testimony is referred, and he says that the passenger, Mr. McNeese, pulled on the steering wheel. Mr. Goldick apparently abandons this "it wasn't my fault" theory in favor of "I did it." He pled guilty to first degree assault. I think it's Judge Carpenter said there's just no point in sending this to a trial. I think this argument supports Judge Carpenter. This is all there is in the entire record that the appellants can come up with. A hearsay testimony, whether admissible or not, it's still hearsay. It's still Mr. Batten saying, "This is what I was told at the Mr. Goldick."
What about the person who supposedly did the pulling on the steering wheel, Mr. McNeese? Is it was he deposed?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I don't think he's ever corroborated this, nor has anyone else. There is nobody who's corroborated it. I don't think Mr. Goldick's been deposed. I don't think he's going to come and say this is the way it happened.
Has there not been discovery yet, or what?
There's been discovery in the underlying tort case, yes. There is a good deal of character testimony offered about Mr. McNeese, that he's a bad fellow and he drinks 24 beers at a sitting and he's nasty and arrogant. That seems all inadmissible under Rule 404 as character evidence offered to prove that a certain behavior occurred. So the record as it stood before Judge Carpenter was just overwhelming. He just saw no point in asking a Delaware jury to determine whether this was an accident or whether Mr. Goldick committed these acts intentionally or with the expectation that injury would result. He drove a van accelerating into 11 people. People are deemed to intend the consequences of their actions. He pled guilty to an assault which contains in it language which conforms to his behavior. And Judge Carpenter relied upon that.
So you're arguing that the guilty plea to assault is dispositive of whatever fact issue, if any, may exist in the record?
I think it is dispositive, Your Honor, but I don't think the record otherwise should be ignored. The jury is going to hear this enormous amount of evidence showing that Goldick just retaliated and ran right into people and then pled guilty. I think the guilty plea to assault kind of disposes of this.
Well, this is a summary judgment case. This is a summary judgment case. If there is admissible evidence that goes the other way on an issue, a fact that's material, you know, the fact that there may be overwhelming evidence on the side that favors your position is not enough. So one question is there admissible evidence that creates a dispute of fact at all? And secondly, is that dispute cognizable once you take into account the guilty plea?
I can't say that the hearsay testimony of Christopher Batten, as found in his deposition, would not be admitted. I think the guilty plea to the assault first degree is dispositive.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to clear up the record in terms of the facts, it was McNeese who got in the altercation in the bar. It was not Goldick. Yes, it was Goldick who was at the wheel, but McNeese was the one who was in the fight. If anyone had reason to grab that wheel and yank it, it was McNeese.
Did McNeese plead guilty to anything?
I know he was charged, Your Honor, but I can't tell you what occurred with McNeese.
And is there any explanation for not having any testimony from him?
Very difficult finding either Goldick. I don't know about McNeese in terms of whether I don't think he works for LAP. It's never been said that he still works for them. Whereabouts is the issue. Also, I don't think it's dispositive, the fact that you plea guilty to even assault charge in Delaware. And we made the argument in argument 3 of the reply brief that says that it's not a conclusive admission. If in fact McNeese actually yanked the wheel, even though Goldick pled guilty, Goldick should have the opportunity to come into court, or at least the appellant should be able to try to locate him and bring him into court to explain why he pled guilty if, in fact, he contends that McNeese pulled the wheel. I think there really is a issue of material fact. And the other reason that's so important is under Ohio law, if you were to uphold the expected or intended injury exclusion, if it was McNeese that yanked the wheel and not Goldick, well, then it isn't dispositive. It isn't a conclusive. That exclusion would then not apply. So, yes, it may apply under Ohio law if Goldick is at the wheel and drives into or expects to injure the appellants. But if McNeese yanks the wheel and injures the appellants, that exclusion would not apply even under Ohio law, and that's why it's important.
If McNeese yanks the wheel and causes the car to run, you know, over the bodies of various people, I gather that fact would negate the other driver's guilt of assault, correct?
Well, of course. I mean, yes, it would at least be a response, or it would be a rebuttable presumption. We can at least rebut the presumption at trial.
The party that pled guilty to assault would not have committed assault if that version of the facts were correct.
That's correct.
Did plead guilty to assault.
Well, a lot of people plead guilty for various reasons. They could be concerned about the sentencing. They could be concerned about the ultimate disposition.
It doesn't matter, does it, if the guilty plea concludes the fact that's at issue here?
But it's not a conclusive admission. It's something that the appellants have the right to rebut at trial. If there's a reason why he did it, and there's been no testimony to that effect, but if there is, he should be able to come into court and explain his reasons as to why he pled guilty to those charges if, in fact, he yanked the wheel.
But if you're saying that you might have the facts with which to rebut this, I would assume, fairly strong presumption, don't you have some obligation on summary judgment to give the court some of those facts, as opposed to, you know, you don't have McNeese's testimony, you don't have Golder's testimony, you've got some third party who says, this is what so-and-so told me about what happened.
Yes, but
presumably, that's all you're going to have when you get to trial, too, unless you're telling me that now somehow you're going to get some additional information.
Well, it still creates an issue of material fact. I mean, first of all, Goldick did say it, so it is an admission by a party opponent. It's admissible. It can come in, whether it may not be a lot of evidence, but it's something that should be able to defeat a motion for summary judgment.
Who offered that hearsay testimony?
Christopher Batten. In terms of the judge?
No. You're saying that this is an admission of a party and can be used against that party. But the party here is the one that's offering that testimony himself.
The party who's offering is Christopher Batten, who was a crew member assigned to Goldick's crew. He was one of the members in Delaware with Goldick at the time. So it was his testimony that said, hey, Goldick called me that night, I was a fellow crew member, here's the explanation of the accident he gave, here's what he told me happened. He's the one who told me that McNeese grabbed the wheel and pulled it to the right. Now, if I could just...
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. We appreciate the audience, and we'll take a brief recess.
Please rise.